Solus Rex. As always happened, the king was awakened by the clash between the pre-dawn watch and the mid-morning one, Mordamervag, Erldagvag. The former, unduly punctual, would leave its post at the prescribed minute, while the latter would be late by a constant number of seconds, not because of negligence, but probably because somebody's gouty timepiece was habitually slow. Therefore, those departing and those arriving always met at one and the same place, the narrow footpath directly under the king's bedroom window, between the rear wall of the palace and a tangled growth of dense but meagerly blooming honeysuckle, under which was scattered all manner of trash, chicken feathers, broken earthenware, and large red-cheeked tin cans that had contained Pomona, a national brand of preserved fruit. The meeting would invariably be accompanied by the muffled sound of a brief, good-natured tussle, and it was this that awakened the king, as one of the pre-dawn sentries, being of a roguish bent, would pretend he did not want to surrender the slate bearing the password to one of the mid-morning men, an irritable and stupid old codger, veteran of the Svirilhum campaign. Then all would grow still again, and the only audible sound would be the business-like, now and then accelerating, crepitation of rain, which would systematically fall for precisely 306 days out of 365 or six, so that the weather's peripeties had long since ceased to trouble anyone. Here, the wind addressed the honeysuckle. The king made a right turn out of his sleep and propped a big white fist under his cheek, on which the blazon embroidered on the pillowcase had left the chessboard impression. Between the inside edges of the brown, loosely drawn curtains, in the single but broad window, there seeped a beam of soapy light, and the king at once remembered an imminent duty, his presence at the inauguration of a new bridge across the Eigel, whose disagreeable image seemed inscribed with geometric inevitability into that pale trigon of day. He was not interested in bridges, canals, or shipbuilding, and even though after 5 years, yes, exactly 5 years, 826 days, of nebulous rain, he really ought to have acquired the habit of attending diligently to a multitude of matters that filled him with loathing because of their organic sketchiness in his mind, where very different things in no way related to his royal office were infinitely and unquenchably perfect. He felt depressingly aggravated every time he was obliged to have contact, not only with anything that demanded a false smile from his deliberate ignorance, but also with that which was nothing more than a veneer of conventional standards on a senseless or perhaps even non-existent object. If the inauguration of the bridge, the plans for which he did not even remember, though he had no doubt approved them, struck him as merely a vulgar festival, it was also because nobody ever bothered to inquire whether he was interested in that intricate fruit of technology, suspended in mid-air, and yet today he would have to ride slowly across in a lustrous convertible with a toothy grill, and this was torture. And then there was that other engineer about whom people had been telling him ever since he had happened to mention, just like that, simply to get rid of someone or something, that he would enjoy doing some climbing, if only the island had a single decent mountain. The old, long-dead coastal volcano did not count, and furthermore, a lighthouse, which incidentally did not work either, had been built on its summit. This engineer, whose dubious fame thrived in the drawing rooms of court ladies and courtesans, attracted by his honey-brown complexion and insinuating speech, had proposed elevating the central part of the insular plain and transforming it into a mountain massif, by means of a subterranean inflation. The inhabitants of the chosen locality would be allowed to remain in their dwellings while the soil was being puffed up. Poltroons who preferred to withdraw from the test area where their little brick houses huddled and amazed red cows mooed, sensing the change in altitude, would be punished by their having to spend much more time on their return along the newly formed escarpments than they had on their recent retreat over the doomed flatland. Slowly the meadows swelled. Boulders moved their round backs. A lethargic stream tumbled out of bed and, to its own surprise, turned into an alpine waterfall. Trees traveled in file cloudward, and many of them, the firs, for instance, enjoyed the ride. The villagers, leaning on their porch railings, waved their handkerchiefs and admired the pneumatic development of landscape. So the mountain would grow and grow until the engineer ordered that the monstrous pumps be stopped. The king, however, did not wait for the stoppage, but dozed off again, with barely time to regret that constantly resisting as he did the counselor's readiness to support the realization of every harebrained scheme, while on the other hand his most natural, most human rights were constricted by rigid laws, he had not given permission for the experiment, and now it was too late. The inventor had committed suicide after patenting a gallows tree for indoor use. Thus, anyway, the spirit of slumber retold it to the slumberer. The king slept on till 7:30, and, at the habitual minute, his mind jolted into action and was already on its way to meet Fry, when Fry entered the bedroom. That decrepit, asthmatic Kornwacher invariably emitted in motion a queer supplementary sound, as if he were in a great hurry, although haste was apparently not in his line, seeing he had not yet got around to dying. He lowered a silver basin onto a tabouret with a heart design cut out in its seat, as he had already been doing for 50 years under 2 kings. Today he was waking a third, for whose predecessors this vanilla-scented and seemingly witch-charmed water had probably served an ablutionary purpose. Now, however, it was quite superfluous. And yet every morning the basin and tabouret appeared, along with a towel that had been folded 5 years before. Continuing to emit his special sound, the old valet admitted the daylight in its entirety. The king always wondered why Fry did not open the curtains first, instead of groping in the penumbra to move the tabouret with its useless utensil toward the bed. But speaking to Fry was out of the question, because of his deafness, that went so well with the snow owl white of his hair. He was cut off from the world by the cotton wool of old age, and, as he went out with a bow to the bed, the wall clock in the bedroom began to tick-tack more distinctly, as if it had been given a recharge of time. The bedroom now came into focus, with the dragon-shaped crack traversing its ceiling and the huge clothes-tree standing like an oak in the corner. An admirable ironing-board stood leaning against the wall. A thing for yanking one's riding-boot off by the heel, an obsolete appliance in the shape of a huge cast-iron stag-beetle, lurked under the border of an armchair robed in a white furniture cover. An oak wardrobe, obese, blind, and drugged by naphthalene, stood next to an ovoid wickerwork receptacle for soiled linen, set on end there by some unknown Columbus. Various objects hung at random on the bluish walls. A clock. It had already tattled about its presence. A medicine cabinet, an old barometer that indicated remembered rather than real weather. A pencil sketch of a lake with reeds and a departing duck. A myopic photograph of a leather-legged gentleman astride a blurry-tailed horse held by a solemn groom in front of a porch, the same porch with strained-faced servants assembled on its steps, some fluffy flowers pressed under dusty glass in a circular frame. The paucity of the furnishings and their utter irrelevance to the needs and the tenderness of whomever used this spacious bedroom, once, it seems, inhabited by the Husmutter, as the wife of the preceding king had been dubbed, gave it an oddly untenanted appearance. And if it were not for the intrusive basin and the iron bed, on the edge of which sat a man in a nightshirt with a frilly collar, his strong bare feet resting upon the floor, it was impossible to imagine that anyone spent his nights here. His toes groped for and found a pair of Morocco slippers, and, donning a dressing gown as gray as the morning, the king walked across the creaking floorboards to the felt-padded door. When he subsequently recalled that morning, it seemed to him that, upon arising, he had experienced, both in mind and in muscles, an unaccustomed heaviness, the fateful burden of the coming day, so that the awful misfortune which that day brought, and which, beneath the mask of trivial boredom, stood already on guard at the Eagle Bridge, absurd and unforeseeable as it was, thereafter seemed to him a kind of resolvent. We are inclined to attribute to the immediate past, I just had it in my hands, I put it right there, and now it's not there, lineaments relating it to the unexpected present, which in fact is but a bounder pluming himself on a purchased escutcheon. We, the slaves of linked events, endeavor to close the gap with a spectral ring in the chain. As we look back, we feel certain that the road we see behind us is the very one that has brought us to the tomb or the fountainhead near which we find ourselves. Life's erratic leaps and lapses can be endured by the mind only when signs of resilience and quagginess are discoverable in anterior events. Such, incidentally, were the thoughts that occurred to the no longer independent artist Dmitri Nikolaevich Zinusov. And evening had come, and in vertically arranged ruby letters glowed the word Renault. The king set out in search of breakfast. He never knew in which of the five possible chambers situated along the cold stone gallery, with cobwebs in the corners of its ogival windows, his coffee would be waiting. Opening the doors one by one, he kept trying to locate the little set table, and finally found it where it happened least frequently, under a large, opulently dark portrait of his predecessor. King Gafon was portrayed at the age at which he remembered him, but features, posture, and bodily structure were endowed with a magnificence that had never been characteristic of that stoop-shouldered, fidgety, and sloppy old man with a peasant crone's wrinkles above his hairless and somewhat crooked upper lip. The words of the family arms, see and rule, sased ud halstom, used to be changed by wags when referring to him to armchair and filbert brandy, sasa ud hazel. He reigned 30-odd years, arousing neither particular love nor particular hatred in anyone, believing equally in the power of good and the power of money, docile in his acquiescence to the parliamentary majority whose vapid humanitarian aspirations appealed to his sentimental soul, and generously rewarding from a secret treasury the activities of those deputies whose devotion to the crown assured its stability. Kingcraft had long since become for him the flywheel of a mechanical habit, and the benighted submissiveness of the country, where the Peplerhus, Parliament, faintly shone like a bleary and crackling rushlight, appeared as a similar form of regular rotation. And if the very last years of his reign were poisoned nevertheless by bitter sedition, coming as a belch after a long and carefree dinner, not he was to blame, but the person and behavior of the Crown Prince. Indeed, in the heat of vexation, good burghers found that the one-time scourge of the learned world, the now-forgotten Professor Van Skunk, did not err much when he affirmed that childbearing was but an illness, and that every babe was an externalized, self-existent parental tumor, often malignant. The present king, pre-accessionally, let us designate him as K, in chess notation, was the old man's nephew. And in the beginning no one dreamed that the nephew would accede to a throne rightfully promised to King Gafon's son, Prince Adolf, whose utterly indecent folk name, based on a felicitous assonance, must, for the sake of decorum, be translated Prince Fig. Kay grew up in a remote palace under the eye of a morose and ambitious grandee, and his horsey masculine wife. So he barely knew his cousin, and started seeing him a little more often only at the age of 20, when Adolf was near 40. We have before us a well-fed, easy-going fellow with a stout neck, a broad pelvis, a big-cheeked, evenly pink face, and fine, bulging eyes. His nasty little mustache, resembling a pair of blue-black feathers, somehow did not match his fat lips, which always looked greasy, as if he had just finished sucking on a chicken bone. His dark, thick, unpleasantly smelling, and also greasy hair lent a foppish something, uncommon in Tula, to his large, solidly planted head. He had a penchant for showy clothes, and was at the same time as unwashed as a popu, seminarian. He was well versed in music, sculpture, and graphics, but could spend hours in the company of dull, vulgar persons. He wept profusely while listening to the melting violin of the great Perelman, and shed the same tears while picking up the shards of a favorite cup. He was ready to help anyone in any way if that moment he was not occupied with other matters, and blissfully wheezing, poking, and nibbling at life, he constantly contrived, in regard to third parties whose existence he did not bother about, to cause sorrows far exceeding in depth that of his own soul. sorrows pertaining to another, the other, world. In his 20th year, Kay entered the University of Ultramar, situated at 400 miles of purple heather from the capital, on the shore of the Grey Sea, and there learned something about the Crown Prince's morals, and would have heard much more if he did not avoid talks and discussions that might overburden his already none too easy anonymity. The Count, his guardian, who came to visit him once a week, sometimes arriving in the sidecar of a motorcycle driven by his energetic wife, continually emphasized how nasty, disgraceful, and dangerous it would be if any of the students or professors learned that this lanky, gloomy youth, who excelled as much at his studies as at Van Bol, on the 200-year-old court behind the library building, was not at all a notary's son, but a king's nephew. Whether it was submission to one of those many whims, enigmatic in their stupidity, with which someone unknown and mightier than the king and the Pepler Hoos together, for some reason troubled the shabby, monotonous northern life, faithful to half-forgotten covenants of that île triste et lointain, or whether the peeved grandee had his own private scheme, his far-sighted calculation, the rearing of kings was supposed to be kept secret, we do not know. Nor was there any reason to speculate about this, since, anyway, the unusual student was busy with other matters. Books, wall ball, skiing. Winters then used to be snowy. But, most of all, nights of special meditation by the hearth. And, a little later, his romance with Belinda. All sufficiently filled up his existence to leave him unconcerned with the vulgar little intrigues of metapolitics. Moreover, while diligently studying the annals of the fatherland, it never occurred to him that within him slumbered the very blood that had coursed through the veins of preceding kings, or that actual life rushing past was also history, history that had issued from the tunnel of the ages into pallid sunlight. Either because his subject of concentration ended a whole century before the reign of Gaffon, or because the magic involuntarily evolved by the most sober chroniclers seemed more precious to him than his own testimony, the bookman in him overcame the eyewitness, and later on, when he tried to re-establish connection with the present, he had to content himself with knocking together provisional passages, which only served to deform the familiar remoteness of legend. That bridge on the Eigel, that blood-spattered bridge. It was then, before the beginning of his second college year, that Kay, having come to the capital for a brief vacation and taken modest lodgings at the so-called Cabinet Members Club, met at the very first court reception the Crown Prince, a boisterous, plump, indecently young-looking charmeur, defying one not to recognize his charm. The meeting took place in the presence of the old king, who sat in a high-backed armchair by a stained-glass window, quickly and nimbly devouring those tiny olive-black plums that were more a delicacy than a medicine for him. Even though Adolf seemed at first not to notice his young relative and continued to address two stooge courtiers, the prince nevertheless started on a subject carefully calculated to fascinate the newcomer, to whom he offered a three-quarter view of himself, paunch-proud, hands thrust deep into the pockets of his wrinkled checked trousers. He stood rocking slightly from heels to toes. "For instance," he said in the triumphant voice he reserved for public occasions, "take our entire history, and you will see, gentlemen, that the root of power has always been construed among us as having originated in magic, with obedience conceivable only when, in the mind of the obeyer, it could be identified with the infallible effect of a spell. In other words, the king was either sorcerer or himself bewitched, sometimes by the people, sometimes by the counselors, sometimes by a political foe who would whisk the crown off his head like a hat from a hat rack. Recall the hoariest antiquity and the rule of the Mossmans, high priests, bog people, the worship of luminescent peat, that sort of thing. Or take those first pagan kings, Gildras and, oh yes, Afadras. And that other one, I forgot what he was called, anyway, the fellow who threw his goblet into the sea, after which for 3 days and nights fishermen scooped up seawater transformed into wine. Sol Guddaivor, Ysagavel, Udiem gotelm quom ostia musicel. Sweet and rich was the wave of the sea, and lassies drank it from seashells. The prince was quoting Uperholm's ballad. And the first friars who arrived in a skiff, equipped with a cross instead of a sail, and all that business of the Fontal Rock, for it was only because they guessed the weak spot of our people that they managed to introduce the crazy Roman creed. What is more, continued the prince, suddenly moderating the crescendos of his voice, for a dignitary of the clergy was now standing a short distance away, if the so-called church never really engorged on the body of our state, and in the last 2 centuries entirely lost its political significance, it is precisely because the elementary and rather monotonous miracles that it was able to produce very soon became a bore. The cleric moved away, and the prince's voice regained its freedom, and could not compete with the natural sorcery, la magie innée et naturelle, of our fatherland. Take the subsequent unquestionably historical kings and the beginning of our dynasty. When Rogfrid I mounted, or rather scrambled up, into the wobbly throne that he himself called a sea-tossed barrel, and the country was in the throes of such insurrection and chaos that his aspiration to kinghood seemed a childish dream, do you recall the first thing he does upon acceding to power? He immediately mints kroons, half-kroons, and groschen, depicting a sex-digitate hand. Why a hand? Why the 6 fingers? Not one historian has been able to figure it out. And it is doubtful that Rogfred even knew himself. The fact remains, however, that this magical measure promptly pacified the country. Later, under his grandson, when the Danes attempted to impose upon us their protégé, and he landed with immense forces, what happened? Suddenly, with the utmost simplicity, the anti-government party, I forget what it was called, anyway, the traitors without whom the whole plot would not have come into existence, sent a messenger to the invader with a polite announcement that they were henceforth unable to support him. Because, you see, the Ling, that is, the heather of the plain across which the turncoat army was to pass to join with the foreign forces, had entwined the stirrups and shins of treachery, thus preventing further advance, which apparently is to be taken literally and not interpreted in the spirit of those stale allegories on which schoolboys are nourished. Then again, ah, yes, a splendid example, Queen Ilda. We must not omit Queen Ilda of the White Breast and the Abundant Amours, who would resolve all state problems by means of incantations, and so successfully that any individual who did not meet her approval would lose his reason. You know yourselves that to this day insane asylums are known among the populace as Ilda Humps. And when that populace begins to take part in legislative and administrative matters, it is absurdly clear that magic is on the people's side. I assure you, for instance, that if poor King Edoric found himself unable to take his seat at the reception for the elected officers, it was certainly not a question of piles, and so on and so forth. The prince was beginning to have enough of the topic he had selected. The life of our country, like some amphibian, keeps its head up amid simple Nordic reality, while submerging its belly in fable, in rich, vivifying sorcery. It's not for nothing that every one of our mossy stones, every old tree, has participated at least once in some magical occurrence or other. Here's a young student. He is reading history. I am sure he will confirm my opinion. As he listened seriously and trustingly to Adolf's reasoning, Kay was astounded to what extent it coincided with his own views. True, the textbook selection of examples adduced by the talkative crown prince seemed to Kay a bit crude. Did not the whole point lie, not in the striking manifestations of witchcraft, but in the delicate shadings of a fantastic something, which profoundly and at the same time mistily colored the island's history? He was, however, unconditionally in agreement with the basic premise, and that was the answer he gave, lowering his head and nodding to himself. Only much later did he realize that the coincidence of ideas which had so astonished him had been the consequence of an almost unconscious cunning on the part of their promulgator, who undeniably had a special kind of instinct that allowed him to guess the most effective bait for any fresh listener. When the king had finished his plums, he beckoned to his nephew and, having no idea what to talk to him about, asked how many students there were at the university. Kay lost countenance. He did not know the number and was not alert enough to name one at random. 500? 1,000? Persisted the king with a note of juvenile eagerness in his voice. I am sure there must be more, he added in a conciliatory tone, not having received an intelligible answer. Then, after a reflective pause, he went on to inquire whether his nephew enjoyed riding. Here the crown prince butted in with his usual luscious unconstraint, inviting his cousin for an outing together the following Thursday. "Astonishing how much he has come to resemble my poor sister," said the king with a mechanical sigh, taking off his glasses and returning them to the breast pocket of his brown frogged jacket. "I am too poor to give you a horse," he continued, "but I have a fine little riding whip. Gotson," addressing the Lord Chamberlain, "where is that fine little riding whip with the doggy's head? Look for it afterwards and give it to him. An interesting little object, historical value and all that. Well, I'm delighted to give it to you, but a horse is beyond my means. All I have is a pair of nags, and I'm keeping them for my hearse. Don't be vexed. I'm not rich." "Il ment," said the crown prince under his breath, and walked off, humming. On the day of the outing the weather was cold and restless. A nacreous sky skimmed overhead. The sallow bushes curtsied in the ravines. The horse hooves plapped as they scattered the slush of thick puddles in chocolate ruts. Crows croaked. And then, beyond the bridge, the riders left the road and set off at a trot across the dark heather, above which a slim, already yellowing birch rose here and there. The crown prince proved to be an excellent horseman, although he had evidently never attended a riding school, for his seat was indifferent. His heavy, broad corduroy and chamois-encased bottom bouncing up and down in the saddle, and his rounded, sloping shoulders aroused in his companion an odd, vague kind of pity, which vanished completely whenever Kay glanced at the prince's rosy face, radiating health and sufficiency, and heard his urgeful speech. The riding whip had come the previous day, but had not been taken. The prince, who, by the way, had set the fashion of using bad French at court, had called it with scorn, "C'est machin ridicule," and contended that it belonged to the groom's little boy, who must have forgotten it on the king's porch. "Et mon bonhomme de père, tu sais, a une vraie passion pour les objets trouvés." "I've been thinking how much truth there is in what you were saying. Books say nothing about it at all." "About what?" asked the prince, laboriously trying to reconstruct which stray theory he had been expounding lately in front of his cousin. "Oh, you remember, the magical origin of power, and the fact—" "Yes, I do, I do," hastily interrupted the prince, and forthwith found the best way to have done with the faded topic. "I didn't finish then because there were too many years around. You see, our whole misfortune lies today in the government's strange ennui, in national inertia, in the dreary bickering of Pepler House members. All this is so because the very force of the spells, both popular and royal, has somehow evaporated, and our ancestral sorcery has been reduced to mere hocus-pocus. But let's not discuss these depressing matters now. Let's turn to more cheerful ones. Say, you must have heard a good deal about me at college. I can imagine. Tell me, what did they talk about?" "Why are you silent?" "They called me a libertine, didn't they?" "I kept away from malicious chatter," said Kay, "but there was indeed some gossip to that effect." "Well, hearsay is the poetry of truth. You are still a boy. Quite a pretty boy, to boot, so there are many things you won't understand right now. I shall offer you only this observation. All people are basically naughty. But when it is done under the rose, when, for instance, you hasten to gorge yourself on jam in a dark corner, or send your imagination on God knows what errands. All that doesn't count. Nobody considers it a crime. Yet when a person frankly and assiduously satisfies the appetites inflicted upon him by his imperious body, then, oh then, people begin to denounce intemperance. And another consideration. If in my case that legitimate satisfaction were limited simply to one and the same unvarying method, popular opinion would become resigned, or at most would reproach me for changing my mistresses too often. But God, what a ruckus they raise, because I do not stick to the code of debauchery, but gather my honey wherever I find it. And mark, I am fond of everything, whether a tulip or a plain little grass stalk, because, you see, concluded the prince, smiling and slitting his eyes, I really seek only the fractions of beauty, leaving the integers to the good burghers, and those fractions can be found in a ballet girl as well as in a docker, in a middle-aged Venus as well as in a young horseman. Yes, said Kay, I understand. You are an artist, a sculptor. You worship form. The prince reined in his horse and guffawed. Oh, well, it isn't exactly a matter of sculpture. À moins que tu ne confondes la galanterie avec la galatée. Which, however, is pardonable at your age. No, no, it's all much less complicated. Only don't be so bashful with me. I won't bite you. I simply can't stand lads qui se tiennent toujours sur leur garde. If you don't have anything more interesting in view, we can return via Grenlog and dine on the lakeside, and then we'll think up something. No, I'm afraid I have something to take care of. It so happens that tonight... Oh, well, I'm not forcing you, the prince said affably, and a little farther by the mill, they said goodbye. As many very shy people would have done in his place, Kay, when forcing himself to face that ride, foresaw an especially trying ordeal for the very reason of Adolf's passing for a jovial talker. With a mild, minor-mode person, it would have been easier to establish the tone of the outing beforehand. As he prepared himself for it, Kay tried to imagine all the awkward moments that might result from the necessity of raising his normal mood to Adolf's sparkling level. Moreover, he felt obligated by their first meeting, by the fact that he had imprudently concurred with the opinions of someone who therefore could rightfully expect that both men would get along just as nicely on subsequent occasions. In making a detailed inventory of his potential blunders, and above all, in fancying with the utmost clarity the tension, the leaden load in his jaws, the desperate boredom he would feel, because of his innate capacity on all occasions for watching askance his projected self, in tabulating all this, including futile efforts to merge with his other self and find interesting such things as were supposed to be interesting, Kay also pursued a secondary practical aim, to disarm the future, whose only force is surprise. In this he nearly succeeded. Fate, constrained by its own evil choice, was apparently content with the innocuous items he had left beyond the field of prevision. The pale sky, the heath country wind, a creaking saddle, an impatiently responsive horse, the unflagging monologue of his self-complacent companion, all fused into a fairly endurable sensation, particularly since Kay had mentally set a certain time limit for the ride. It was only a matter of seeing it through. But when the prince, with a novel proposal, threatened to extend this limit into the unknown, all of whose possibilities had once again to be agonizingly appraised, and here something interesting was again being forced upon Kay, requiring an expression of happy anticipation, this additional period of time, superfluous, unforeseen, was intolerable. And so, at the risk of seeming impolite, he had used the pretext of a non-existent impediment. True, as soon as he turned his horse, he regretted this discourtesy just as acutely as, a moment ago, he had been concerned for his freedom. Consequently, all the nastiness expected from the future deteriorated into a doubtful echo of the past. He thought for a moment if he should not overtake the prince and consolidate the foundation of friendship through a belated, but hence doubly precious, acquiescence to a new ordeal. But his fastidious apprehension of offending a kind, cheerful man did not outweigh his fear of obviously being unable to match that kindness and cheerfulness. Thus it happened that fate outwitted him after all, and by means of a last furtive pinprick rendered valueless that which he was prepared to consider a victory. A few days later he received another invitation from the prince, asking that he drop in any evening of the following week. Kay could not refuse. Moreover, a sense of relief that the other was not offended treacherously smoothed the way. He was ushered into a large yellow room, as hot as a greenhouse, where a score of people, fairly evenly divided by sex, sat on divans, hassocks, and a deep rug. For a fraction of a second the host seemed vaguely perplexed by his cousin's arrival, as if he had forgotten that he had invited him, or thought he had asked him for a different day. However, this momentary expression immediately gave way to a grin of welcome, after which the prince ignored his cousin, and neither, for that matter, was any attention paid to Kay by the other guests, evidently close friends of the prince, extraordinarily thin, smooth-haired young women, half a dozen middle-aged gentlemen with clean-shaven, bronzed faces, and several young men in the open-necked silk shirts that were fashionable at the time. Among them, Kay suddenly recognized the famous young acrobat, Andrik Gulving, a sullen blond boy with a bizarre gentleness of gesture and gait, as if the expressiveness of his body, so remarkable in the arena, were muffled by clothes. To Kay, this acrobat served as a key to the entire constellation of the gathering, and even if the observer was ridiculously inexperienced and chaste, he immediately sensed that those gauze-dim, delectably elongated girls, their limbs folded with varied abandon, who were making not conversation but mirages of conversation, consisting of slow half-smiles and hmms of interrogation or response through the smoke of cigarettes inserted in precious holders, belonged to that essentially deaf and dumb world that in former days had been known as demi-monde, all curtains drawn, no other world known. The fact that interspersed among them were ladies one saw at court balls did not change things in the least. The male group was likewise somehow homogeneous, despite its comprising representatives of the nobility, artists with dirty fingernails and young roughs of the stevedore type. And precisely because the observer was inexperienced and chaste, he immediately had doubts about his initial involuntary impression, and accused himself of common prejudice, of trusting slavishly the trite talk of the town. He decided that everything was in order, i.e. that his world was in no way disrupted by the inclusion of this new province, and that everything about it was simple and comprehensible. A fun-loving, independent person had freely selected his friends. The quietly carefree and even somehow childish rhythm of this gathering was particularly reassuring to Kay. The mechanical smoking, the various dainties on gold-veined little plates, the comradely cycles of motion. Somebody found some sheet music for somebody. A girl tried on another girl's necklace. The simplicity, the serenity, all of it denoted in its own way that kindliness which Kay, who himself did not possess it, recognized in all of life's phenomena, be it the smile of a bonbon in its goffered bonnet, or the echo of an old friendship divined in another small talk. With a frown of concentration, occasionally releasing a series of agitated groans, which would end in a grunt of vexation, the prince was busy trying to drive six tiny balls into the center of a pocket-sized maze of glass. A redhead in a green dress and sandals on her bare feet kept repeating, with comic mournfulness, that he would never succeed. But he persisted for a long time, jiggling the recalcitrant gimmick, stamping his foot and starting all over again. Finally, he tossed it on a sofa, where some of the others promptly started on it. Then a man with handsome features, distorted by a tic, sat down at the piano, struck the keys with disorderly vigor in parody of somebody's way of playing, and right away rose again, whereupon he and the prince began arguing about the talent of a third party, probably the author of the truncated melody, and the redhead, scratching a graceful thigh through her dress, started explaining to the prince the injured party's position in a complicated musical feud. Abruptly, the prince consulted his watch and turned to the blonde young acrobat, who was drinking orangeade in a corner. "Andric," he said with a worried air, "I think it is time." Andric somberly licked his lips, put down his glass, and came over. With fat fingers, the prince undid Andric's fly, extracted the entire pink mass of his private parts, selected the chief one, and started to rub regularly its glossy shaft. "At first," related Kay, "I thought that I had lost my mind, that I was hallucinating." Most of all, he was shocked by the natural quality of the procedure. Nausea dwelled within him, and he left. Once in the street, he even ran for a while. The only person with whom he felt able to share his indignation was his guardian. Although he had no affection for the not very attractive count, he resolved to consult him as the sole familiar he had. He asked the count in despair, how could it be that a man of Adolf's morals, a man, moreover, no longer young, and therefore unlikely to change, would become the ruler of the country? By the light in which he had suddenly seen the crown prince, he also perceived that besides hideous ribaldry, and despite a taste for the arts, Adolf was really a savage, a self-taught oaf, lacking real culture, who had appropriated a handful of its beads, had learned how to flaunt the glitter of his adaptive mind, and, of course, did not worry in the least about the problems of his impending reign. Kay kept asking, was it not crazy nonsense, the delirium of dreams, to imagine such a person king? But in setting those questions, he hardly expected matter-of-fact replies. It was the rhetoric of young disenchantment. Nevertheless, as he went on expressing his perplexity in abrupt, brittle phrases, he was not born eloquent, Kay overtook reality and had a glimpse of its face. Admittedly, he at once fell back again, but that glimpse imprinted itself in his soul, revealing to him in a flash what perils awaited a state doomed to become the plaything of a prurient ruffian. The count heard him out attentively, now and then turning on him the gaze of his lashless, vulturine eyes. They reflected a strange satisfaction. A calculating and cool mentor, he replied most cautiously, as if not quite agreeing with Kay, calming him down by saying that what he had happened to catch sight of was acting upon his judgment with undue force, that the only purpose of the hygiene established by the prince was not to allow a young friend to waste his strength on wenching, and that Adolf had qualities which might show themselves upon his ascension. At the end of the interview, the count offered to have Kay meet a certain wise person, the well-known economist Gum. Here the count pursued a double purpose. On one hand, he freed himself of all responsibility for what might follow, and remained aloof, which would do very nicely in case of some mishap. And on the other hand, he was passing Kay over to an experienced conspirator, thus beginning the realization of a plan that the evil and wily count had been nursing, it seems, for quite a time. Meet Gum. Meet economist Gum, a round-tummied little old man in a woolen waistcoat, with blue spectacles pushed up high on his pink forehead, bouncy, trim, giggly Gum. Their meetings increased in frequency, and at the end of his second year at college, Kay even sojourned for about a week in Gum's house. By that time, Kay had discovered enough things about the crown prince's behavior not to regret that first explosion of indignation. Not so much from Gum himself, who seemed always to be rolling somewhither, as from his relatives and entourage, Kay learned about the measures which had already been tried to subdue the prince. At first, people had attempted to inform the old king about his son's frolics, so as to obtain parental restraint. Indeed, when this or that person, after gaining through the thorns of protocol access to the king's cabinet, depicted frankly those stunts to his majesty, the old man, flushing purple and nervously pulling together the skirts of his dressing gown, displayed greater wrath than one might have hoped for. He shouted that he would put an end to it, that the cup of endurance, wherein his morning coffee stormily splashed, was overflowing, that he was happy to hear a candid report, that he would banish the lecherous cur for 6 months to a Syphilhus monastery ship, floating hermitage, that he would... And when the audience had come to a close, and the pleased official was about to bow his way out, the old king, still puffing but already pacified, would take him aside, with a businesslike, confidential air, though actually they were alone in the study, and say, "Yes, yes, I understand all that. All that is so. But listen, quite between us, tell me, if we look at it reasonably, after all, my Adolf is a bachelor, a gay dog. He's fond of a little sport. Is it necessary to get all worked up? Remember, we also were boys once." That last consideration sounded rather silly, for the king's distant youth had flowed with milky tranquility, and afterwards the late queen, his wife, treated him with unusual severity till he was 60. She was, incidentally, a remarkably obstinate, stupid, and petty-minded woman with a constant propensity for innocent but extremely absurd fantasies, and very possibly it was owing to her that the habitus of the court, and to a certain extent of the state, acquired those peculiar, difficult-to-define features, oddly blending stagnation and caprice, improvidence and the primness of nonviolent insanity that so much tormented the present king. The second, chronologically speaking, form of opposition was considerably deeper. It consisted of rallying and fortifying public resources. One could scarcely rely on the conscious participation of the plebeian class, among the insular plowmen, weavers, bakers, carpenters, cornmongers, fisherfolk, and so forth. The transformation of any crown prince into any king was accepted as meekly as a change in the weather. The rustic gazed at the auroral gleam amid the accumulated clouds, shook his head, and that was all. In his dark, Lycinian brain, a traditional place was always reserved for traditional disaster, national or natural. The meagerness and sluggishness of economics, the frozen level of prices, which had long since lost vital sensitivity, through which there is formed all at once a connection between an empty head and an empty stomach, the grim constancy of inconsiderable but just sufficient harvests, the secret pact between greens and grain, which had agreed, it seemed, to supplement each other and thus hold agronomy in equipoise, all this, according to Gumm, see the basis and anabasis of economics, kept the people in languid submission. And if some sort of sorcery prevailed here, then so much the worse for the victims of its viscous spells. Furthermore, and the enlightened found therein a source of especial sadness, Prince Fig enjoyed a kind of smutty popularity among the lower classes and the petty bourgeoisie, between whom the distinction was so wobbly that one could regularly observe such puzzling phenomena as the return of a shopkeeper's prosperous son to the humble manual trade of his grandfather. The hearty laughter invariably accompanied talk about Fig's pranks prevented them from being condemned. The mask of mirth stuck to one's mouth, and that mimicry of approval could no longer be distinguished from the real thing. The more lewdly Fig romped, the louder folks guffawed. The mightier and merrier red fists thumped on the deal tables of pubs. A characteristic detail. One day, when the prince, passing on horseback, a cigar between his teeth, through a backwoodsy hamlet, noticed a comely little girl to whom he offered a ride, and notwithstanding her parents' horror, which respect barely helped to restrain, swept her away, while her old granddad kept running along the road until he toppled into a ditch. The whole village, as agents reported, expressed their admiration by roars of laughter, congratulated the family, reveled in surmise, and did not stint in mischievous inquiries when the child returned after an hour's absence, holding a 100-kroon note in one hand, and, in the other, a fledgling that had fallen out of its nest in a desolate grove where she had picked it up on her way back to the village. In military circles, displeasure with the prince was based not so much on considerations of general morals and national prestige as on direct resentment suscitated by his attitude toward flaming punch and booming guns. King Gaffon himself, in contrast to his pugnacious predecessor, was a deeply civilian old party. Nonetheless, the army put up with it, his complete non-comprehension of military matters being redeemed by the timorous esteem in which he held them. Per contra, the guard could not forgive his son's open sneer. War games, parades, puff-cheeked music, regimental banquets with the observation of colorful customs, and various other conscientious recreations on the part of the small insular army produced nothing but scornful ennui in Adolf's eminently artistic soul. Yet the army's unrest did not go further than desultory murmurs, plus, maybe, the making of midnight oaths, to the gleam of tapers, goblets, and swords, to be forgotten next morning. Thus the initiative belonged to the enlightened minds of the public, which, sad to say, were not numerous. The anti-Adolfian opposition included, however, certain statesmen, newspaper editors, and jurists, all respectable, tough-sinewed old fellows, wielding plenty of secret or manifest influence. In other words, public opinion rose to the occasion, and the ambition to curb the crown prince, as his iniquity progressed, became considered a sign of decency and intelligence. It only remained to find a weapon. Alas, this precisely was lacking. There existed the press, there existed a parliament, but by the code of the Constitution, the least disrespectful poke at a member of the royal family must result in the newspapers being banned or the chambers dissolved. A single attempt to stir up the nation failed. We are referring to the celebrated trial of Dr. Ons. That trial presented something unparalleled even in the unparalleled annals of Thulian justice. A man renowned for his virtue, a lecturer and writer on civic and philosophical questions, a personality so highly regarded, endowed with such strictness of views and principles, in a word, such a dazzlingly unstained character that, in comparison, the reputation of anyone else appeared spotty, was accused of various crimes against morals, defended himself with the clumsiness of despair, and finally acknowledged his guilt. So far, there was nothing very unusual about it. Goodness knows into what furuncles the mamilli of merit may turn under scrutiny. The unusual and subtle part of the matter lay in the fact that the indictment and the evidence formed practically a replica of all that could be imputed to the crown prince. One could not help being amazed by the precision of details obtained in order to insert a full-length portrait in the prepared frame without touching up or omitting anything. Much of it was so new, and individualized so precisely the commonplaces of long coarsened rumor, that at first the masses did not realize who had sat for the picture. Very soon, however, the daily reports in the papers began to stir up quite exceptional interest among such readers as had caught on, and people who used to pay up to 20 kroons to attend the trial now did not spare 500 or more. The initial idea had been generated in the womb of the Procuratura, magistracy. The oldest judge in the capital took a fancy to it. All one needed was to find a person sufficiently upright not to be confused with the prototype of the affair, sufficiently clever not to act as a clown or a cretin before the tribunal, and in particular sufficiently dedicated to the case to sacrifice everything to it, endure a monstrous mud bath, and exchange his career for hard labor. Candidates for that role were not available. The conspirators, most of them well-to-do family men, liked every part except the one without which the play could not be staged. The situation already looked hopeless, when one day, at a meeting of the plotters, appeared Dr. Ons, dressed entirely in black, and, without sitting down, declared that he put himself completely at their disposal. A natural impatience to grasp the occasion hardly allowed them time to marvel, for at first blush it surely must have been difficult to understand how the rarefied life of a thinker could be compatible with the willingness to be pilloried for the sake of political intrigue. Actually, his was not such an uncommon case. Being constantly occupied with spiritual problems and constantly adapting the laws of the most rigid principles to the most fragile abstractions, Dr. Ons did not find it possible to refuse a personal application of the same method when presented with the opportunity of performing a deed that was disinterested and probably senseless, and therefore still abstract, owing to the utmost purity of its nature. Furthermore, one should remember that Dr. Ons was giving up his chair, the multitude of his book-lined study, the continuation of his latest opus, in brief, everything that a philosopher has the right to treasure. Let us mention that he was in indifferent health. Let us emphasize the fact that before submitting the case to a close examination, he had been obliged to devote 3 nights to delving in rather special works dealing with problems of which an ascetic could know little. And let us add that not long before he took his decision, he had become engaged to a senescent virgin after years of unexpressed love, during which time her fiancé of long standing fought phthisis in distant Switzerland until he expired, hence freeing her of her pact with compassion. The case started by that truly heroic female's suing Dr. Ons for allegedly luring her to his secret garçonnière, a den of luxury and libertinism. A similar claim, the only difference being that the apartment surreptitiously taken and fitted by the conspirators was not the one which the prince used to rent at one time for special pleasures, but faced it on the opposite side of the street, which immediately established the mirror image idea characteristic of the entire trial, had been filed against Fig by a not overbright maiden, who did not happen to know that her seducer was the heir to the throne, i.e. a person who in no circumstances could be arraigned. There followed the testimony of numerous witnesses, some of them altruistic adherents, others paid agents. There had not been quite enough of the first. Their declarations had been brilliantly composed by a committee of experts, among whom one noted a distinguished historian, 2 major literati, and several experienced jurists. In these declarations, the activity of the Crown Prince developed gradually, in the correct chronological order, but with some calendric abridgment compared to the time it had taken the Prince to exasperate the public so badly. Group fornication, ultra-earningism, abduction of youngsters, and many other amusements were described to the accused in the form of detailed questions, to which he replied much more briefly. Having studied the whole affair with the methodical diligence peculiar to his mentality, Dr. Ons, who had never considered theatrical art, in fact, he did not go to the theater, now, by means of a savant's approach, unconsciously achieved a splendid impersonation of the kind of criminal whose denial of the charge, an attitude which in the present case was meant to let the prosecution get into its stride, finds nourishment in contradictory statements and assistance in bewildered stubbornness. Everything proceeded as planned. Alas, it soon became clear that the conspirators had no idea what really to hope for. But the eyes of the people to open? But the people knew all along Fig's nominal value. For moral revulsion to turn into civic revolt? But nothing indicated the way to such a metamorphosis. Or maybe the whole scheme was to be but a link in a long chain of progressively more efficient disclosures? But then the boldness and bite of the affair, by the very fact of their lending it an unrepeatable character of exclusiveness, could not help breaking, between the first link and the next, a chain that demanded above all some gradual form of malleation. The publication of all the details of the case only helped to enrich the papers. Their circulation grew to such an extent that in the resulting lush shade certain alert people, as for example Cien, managed to create new organs which pursued this or that object, but whose success was guaranteed because of their reports on the trial. The honestly indignant citizens were vastly outnumbered by the lip-smackers and the curious. Plain folks read and laughed. In those public proceedings they saw a marvelously entertaining gag thought up by rascals. The Crown Prince's image acquired in their minds the aspect of a Punchinello, whose varnished pate gets, perhaps, thumped by the stick of a mangy devil, but who remains the pet of the gapers, the star of the showbox. On the other hand, the personality of sublime Dr. Ons not only failed to be recognized as such, but provoked happy hoots of malice, echoed disgracefully by the yellow press, the populace having mistaken his position for a wretched readiness to please on the part of a bribed highbrow. In a word, The pornographic popularity which had always surrounded the prince was only augmented, and even the most ironic conjectures as to how he must feel reading about his own escapades bore the mark of that good nature with which we involuntarily encourage another chap's showy recklessness. The nobility, the counselors, the court, and courtierist members of the Peplerhus were caught napping. They tamely decided to lie in wait and thus lost invaluable political tempo. True, a few days before the verdict, members of the royalist party succeeded, by intricate or merely crooked means, in getting a law passed forbidding the newspapers to report on divorce cases or other hearings apt to contain scandalous items. But as constitutionally, no law could be enforced until 40 days had elapsed since its acceptance, a period termed parturiency of Temis, the papers had ample time to cover the trial to the very end. Prince Adolf himself regarded the business with complete indifference, which, moreover, was so naturally expressed that one wondered if he understood about whom they really were talking. Since every scrap of the affair must have been familiar to him, one is forced to conclude that either he had suffered an amnesic shock, or that his self-control was superb. Once only his intimates thought they saw a shadow of vexation flit across his large face. "What a pity!" he cried. "Why didn't that polisson invite me to his parties? Que de plaisir perdu!" As to the king, he also looked unconcerned. But to judge by the way he cleared his throat while filing away the newspaper in a drawer and removing his reading glasses, and also by the frequency of his secret sessions with this or that counselor, summoned at an unseasonable hour, one gathered that he was strongly perturbed. It was said that during the days of the trial he offered several times, with feigned casualness, to lend his son the royal yacht so that Adolf might undertake a little round-the-world voyage. But Adolf only laughed and kissed him on his bald spot. "Really, my dear boy," insisted the old king, "it's so delightful being at sea. You might take musicians with you, a barrel of wine." "Alas," answered the prince, "a seesawing sea line compromises my solar plexus." The trial entered its final stage. The defense alluded to the accused's youth, to his hot blood, to the temptations attending a bachelor's life, all of which was a rather coarse parody of the king's overindulgence. The prosecutor made a speech of savage force and overshot the mark by demanding the death penalty. The defendant's last word introduced an utterly unexpected note. Exhausted by lengthy tension, harrowed by having been forced to wallow in another's filth, and involuntarily staggered by the prosecutor's blast, the luckless scholar lost his nerve, and after a few incoherent mumblings suddenly started, in a new, hysterically clear voice, to tell how one night in his youth, having drunk his first glass of hazel brandy, he accepted to go with a classmate to a brothel, and how he did not get there only because he fainted in the street. This unforeseen avowal convulsed the public with long laughter, while the prosecutor, losing his head, attempted to stop the defendant's mouth by physical means. Then the jury retired for a silent smoke to the room allotted to them, and presently came back to announce the verdict. It was suggested that Dr. Ons be sentenced to 11 years hard labor. The sentence was wordily approved by the press. At secret visits his friends shook hands with the martyr as they took farewell of him. But here good old Gaffon, for the first time in his life, unexpectedly for everybody, including, maybe, his own self, acted rather wittily. He took advantage of an incontestable prerogative and granted Ons a full pardon. Thus both the first and second modes of pressure upon the prince practically came to nothing. There remained a third, a most decisive in certain way. All the talks in Gum's entourage tended exclusively toward the realization of that third measure, though its actual name, apparently, nobody pronounced. Death enjoys a sufficient number of euphemisms. K, upon getting involved in the tangled circumstances of a plot, did not quite make out what was happening, and the reason of that blindness lay not solely in youthful inexperience, It depended upon his considering himself instinctively, though quite erroneously, to be the main instigator, whereas, of course, he was no more than an honorary walk-on actor or an honorary hostage, and therefore refusing to believe that the enterprise he had initiated could end in bloodshed. Indeed, no enterprise really existed, since he vaguely felt that by the very act of surmounting his disgust in studying his cousin's life, he was accomplishing something sufficiently important and needful. And when, with the passing of time, he got a little bored with that study and with constant talks about the same thing, he still kept participating in them, dutifully stuck to the tedious topic, and continued to think he was performing his duty by collaborating with some kind of force that remained obscure to him, but that finally would transform, by a stroke of its wand, an impossible prince into an acceptable heir apparent. Even if it occurred to him to welcome the possibility of simply forcing Adolf to forego his claim to the throne, and the vagaries of figurative speech used by the plotters might have chanced to imply such an interpretation, he, strangely enough, never brought that thought to the end, i.e., to himself as the next in line. For almost 2 years, in the margin of college work, he constantly associated with Rotund Gum and his friends, and imperceptibly found himself caught in a very dense and delicate web. And perhaps the enforced boredom he felt more and more keenly should not be reduced to the mere incapacity, otherwise characteristic of his nature, to keep concerned with things that gradually grew the integument of habit, through which he no longer distinguished the radiance of their passionate revival, but perhaps it was the deliberately changed voice of a subliminal warning. Meanwhile, the business that had been commenced long before his participation in it neared its gory denouement. On a cold summer evening, he was invited to a secret assembly. He went, for the invitation hinted at nothing unusual. Later he recalled, it is true, how unwillingly, with what a burdensome sense of compulsion, he set out for the meeting, but with similar feelings he had gone to meetings before. In a large room, unheated and, as it were, fictitiously furnished, wallpaper, fireplace, sideboard with dusty drinking horn on one shelf, all looked like stage properties, there sat a score of men, more than half of whom Kay did not know. Here, for the first time, he saw Dr. Ons, that marble-white calvity depressed along its middle, those thick blonde eyelashes, the little freckles above the brows, the rufous shade on the cheekbones, the tightly compressed lips, the frock coat of a fanatic, and the eyes of a fish. A frozen expression of meek, lambent melancholy did not embellish his unfortunate features. He was addressed with pointed respect. Everyone knew that after the trial his fiancée had broken with him, explaining that she irrationally went on seeing on the wretched man's face the traces of soily vice to which he had confessed in assuming another's character. She retired to a distant village, where she became wholly absorbed in teaching, and Dr. Ons himself, soon after the event prefaced by that assembly, sought reclusion in a smallish monastery. Among those present, Kay also noted the celebrated jurist Schliss, several fraud, liberal members of the Peplerhus, the son of the Minister of Public Education, and on an uncomfortable leathern divan sat three lanky and somber army officers. He found a cane-seated free chair next to the window, on whose ledge sat a small man who kept apart from the others. He had a plebeian type of face and fiddled with the postal department cap in his hands. Kay was close enough to observe his coarse-shod huge feet, which did not go at all with his puny figure, so that one obtained something like a photograph taken at point-blank range. Only later did Kay learn that this man was Cien. At first it seemed to Kay that the people collected in the room were engaged in the kind of talk which had long grown familiar to him. Something within him, again that innermost friend, even longed with a sort of childish eagerness that this meeting would not differ from all previous ones. But Gum's strange, somehow sickening gesture, when in passing he put his hand on Kay's shoulder and nodded mysteriously, This, as well as the slow, guarded sound of voices and the expression of those three officers' eyes, caused Kay to prick up his ears. Hardly 2 minutes passed before he knew that what they were coldly working out here, in this bogus room, was the already decided assassination of the Crown Prince. He felt the breath of fate near his temples, and the same almost physical nausea he had once experienced after that soiree at his cousin's. By the look which the silent pygmy in the embrasure gave him, a look of curiosity mixed with sarcasm, Kay realized that his confusion had not passed unnoticed. He got up, and then everyone turned toward him, and the bristly-haired, heavy man who was speaking at that minute, Kay had long ceased to hear the words, stopped short. Kay went up to Gum, whose triangular eyebrows rose expectantly. "I must be going," said Kay. "I'm not feeling well. I think I had better go." He bowed. A few persons politely stood up. The man on the window ledge lit his pipe, smiling. As Kay advanced toward the exit, he had the nightmare sensation that, maybe, the door was a still-life painting, that its handle was en trompe-l'œil and could not be turned. But all at once the door became real, and, escorted by a youth who had softly come out of some other room in his bed-slippers with a bundle of keys, Kay proceeded to go down a long and dark staircase.